Right.
Some of the usual inmates are either not here this evening or they may chime in later. No, it's always hard to tell.
Right.
I'm not a very publicly available or necessarily popular person. Everything that we do is, you know, kind of casual.
I really appreciate that, actually. And it's, I had, when I was joining, I was assuming I was just going to be listening to a talk. I don't usually like to listen to myself talk,
You might be able to get over your shyness, who can say?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, feel free to stumble into it. Was there anything in, you know, recordings or Facebook stuff that inspired or bothered you, or that may have conjured a, you know, a question in your own mind? I mean, I can't say I know anything or have any, you know, canned reply, but we can play with it if you like.
I enjoy your bluntness and honesty. I do have one question on your webpage. Starting practice. You know, I've been a practitioner, I guess, for a long time, mainly in the Buddhist lineage, but
yes,
I've always found meditation to be a bit of a difficult. I guess I'm not very good at it. And
you're lucky.
I guess. But
what kind of Buddhist training have you been influenced by?
I guess the most one I've been involved with was the Shambhala, the Chogyam Trungpa.
Okay.
Yeah, so Tibetan. But, you know, initially when I was, you know, going all the way back to about 1990, I mean, reading Zen, Zen books, and you know, sort of been around the block, and still admire a lot of that, but a lot of it leaves me cold as well. So
another stroke of luck.
Yeah, and then I don't know. It just seems in the last year or two, I've been reading more non-duality type things, whether it's Peter Brown. And I really do gravitate to his style, and I think you're kind of similar. And you sort of, if it's the game of tennis, you know, the ball's back in my court in that sense, I think, from you guys. And I like that. It's not,
right.
You're not sitting up high kind of thing, it seems like.
Yeah, really. Find me the throne. I'm sure I'll fall out of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure maggots, you know, were able to get their hands on every saint that ever lived, perhaps with the exception of Jesus, if he actually was lucky enough to ascend.
Right.
Yeah. What kind of non-duality teachers besides Peter has piqued your curiosity?
Well, I suppose the first one was Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I've Francis Lucille. Some of the bigger names. But then it's felt sort of similar to sort of the Buddhist path, where it's all retreats and megabucks and that I just don't know. I mean, I still like the writings, and I really do appreciate the writings, but I don't know if I want to go down that road again, kind of thing.
Yeah, right. Well, the power of now is fun to play with. I imagine it was somewhat evocative when you first read it.
It really was, and it was. I like the fact that I think there's a lot of Westerners in non-duality, and they don't seem to be afraid to at least talk about whether it's, you know, the big enlightenment, or it's not a taboo subject, which.
Yeah.
I felt that it was in, you know, it's in Buddhism. It always felt like, you know, they'd be talking many lifetimes down the road, and I never quite grasped that.
Yeah, you wonder why.
Yeah.
Maybe they just turn out to be a bunch of posers and they just don't want to take it on.
Well, I think that's a pretty good point, yeah. So the frankness of the non-duality was appreciated. And then I suppose some of the big, I mean, I love reading I Am That from Nisargadatta.
Sure. Are you a one-time reader or do you have a war-torn copy?
One-time reader. But, you know, sometimes it's one of those books, it almost feels electric. You just read a page or two and you have to put it down. It feels...
I know the feeling. Yeah, I hear you.
So I love that.
Yes.
But I must say, your Facebook posts, I did download your ebook, and I really appreciated that. Your style of writing is really, I mean, you've got good humor, but it's to the point. It's really good writing.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. I, you know, like you, you could say I'm a veteran of these teachings, you know, whether Buddhist or Hindu or non-dual or blah, blah. And I can identify with the lovely affectation of going into an I am that sort of haze. And maybe it's my own dunce-ness or rigidity. It's hard to say. But I always sought, you know, something that was, I don't know, profoundly deliberate or profoundly direct in a vocabulary that I could identify with and make my own, rather than simply being a voyeur, you know? And my own relationship with Peter Brown, which began in early 2009, was, you know, a really refreshing encounter in that Peter's style of pointing and... I guess you could say encouragement with respect to the nature of what he coins radiant presence was that kind of bold, you know, missing piece that is even hinted at in Nirsagadatta's work and even more obscure in Ramesh's work and as much or more obscure in Wayne Lickerman's work. So,
I guess sort of agree with that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I have listened to some talks by Wayne Lickerman, not so much Ramesh Palsekar, but...
Right.
But it is also nice to see that even students of a teacher have been successful, I guess, you know, and it's encouraging anyway, whereas in other practices, whether it was Vipassana that I've been interested in or... success was almost frowned upon or something. I don't know how to describe that.
Yeah, no, good point. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's like Buddhism in the hands of the Buddha, you could say, was intended to be realizable, which would be tantamount to the cessation of Buddhism. But, you know, after the founder's passing... I mean, the founder had no interest in Buddhism. The founder only had interest in the radical wakefulness of Buddha, right?
Right.
But shortly after the founder's passing, all of the muggles that take the lethal potential of the teachings and they turn it into another cow, right? Another golden calf. So since then, you've had, of course, you know, many illustrious personas from generation to generation that have, let's say, woken up within the bosom of Buddhism. But maybe you could argue fewer and fewer and fewer, right?
Yeah.
Have the benefit of that radicalization of their own consciousness.
Yeah.
And so what we see practiced today, whether in the West or arguably the East as well, is worship of Buddhism, which is a very different game than radical ruination in the heart of Buddha.
Right.
And it takes whatever it takes, you know, a certain kind of restlessness or urgency or frustration, devotion, don't ask me what the mix is, to break free of the conformity and the hallucination of worshiping Buddhism. You could say it's a lonely and powerful day when you turn your back on the worship of Buddhism. And I think that even Nirsagadatta's work, as cogent and heartwarming as it is, also becomes, you know, a fetish of a kind. And then it becomes a, you know, kind of a worship of Nirsagadatta, or a worship of his realization, or the evocative teachings. And we fall into the same dilemma, that we start worshiping second-hand presentations of the radical ruination of actual liberation. And then people become experts, right, in the field of non-duality, or in the field of Dzogchen or Kashmiri Shaivism, and the guru worship and the ritualisms and the worship of books and teachings persists, when all of that is just second-hand news.
Yeah. Well, you just have to be vigilant with yourself, I suppose. Is that the way? And that's, you know, the whole, I guess originally, when I was even a teenager, I was interested in, it's almost like, I feel like I've come back where Joseph Campbell's writings appeal to me again, where it's, you know, where he opened up the world of the East to me, and then
right.
Buddhism, but I really, his central, I think his idea is, you know, you yourself, you've got to walk the path, and I don't know. That's how I almost round about again.
He, you know, again, he was, well, he was a reporter, right? He was a documentarian.
He was, yeah. And hero worship, I mean, that's not, I understand that that's not the right way either, but.
It helps. Yeah. We'll get to that subtle point in a moment. So let's be crazy about this, right? Because I think that's what it takes. Consciousness, if that's what this is, right, if we can refer to consciousness as kind of an embracing metaphor for the presence of experience, right? Okay. So the question is, simple question, does consciousness actually convey agency?
I don't know if I could answer that myself. But,
yeah. Well, maybe not today, or maybe not right now, but you could say that the gateway to liberation is the answer to that question.
Right.
Because there's no liberation available in your past, right? That's come
yes.
and gone. That ship
yes.
left the harbor.
Right.
And there's no liberation in your future, because you don't possess a future. you know, imaginarily so, you can ruminate in the present about what
service what, to that. I right? agree with that.
Yeah.
I pay lip service to that, where I do agree with that. But then in my, I think deep down where I am right now, I do believe there is a future, but I appreciate your, the way you lay it out. It's true. There really isn't. There isn't now.
Okay. So let's say slowly or suddenly, either one works, right? Your instinct or suspicion about having a future, you know, may shift, right? Yeah. So superficially, you may have some loyalty to the hope that you have a future, but you also possess, through no effort of your own, a sufficient suspicion that you may not have one.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you can agree, again, either superficially, and I don't mean that in a disparaging manner, or either superficially or with great gusto, that you do or do not have a past. So either way, it's a worth tangling with the potency that present experience is the only interface that you have as an enjoyer or sufferer of what we might refer to as consciousness or reality. Or we'll dare use Nirsagadatta's term, the absolute.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
So this present moment, not that there is one, not that it has any duration, not that we have to, you know, put it on a float and go down Main Street, but if there is consciousness, if there is an absolute and or what it conveys, well, it has to be pretty much right now.
Okay.
Even though memory appears in one's actuality, right? Memory is hallucinatory. And so the past and the future, that memory and or projection may refer to, are appearing hallucinatorially, if we can use that word, in this present moment. And we can see how quickly and with what level of confidence, as a confidence game, consciousness, let's say, is capable of convincing us that, oh, of course, we are the product of a past and the keen anticipators of a future. And those are psychiatric, right? Those are imagined. Because the only interface we've actually ever known is the curious nature of what we might refer to as the present. And the present is strangely bizarre because it seems to come and go and mark the passage of time, right, geophysically or even biologically. And even though the present expresses itself as the apparent passage of time, it's only just present. And you can't find an actual time zone, as in past and future, other than the miraculous stimulation of your present presence. Here we are. Here this is. And so when we self-accuse, namely, my life has sucked, and for good reason, and I'd like my life not to suck, for good reason, and maybe I have a curiosity about this bizarre fetish referred to as self-realization, as a vehicle, as a terminus, for my life to not suck any longer. That's conjured kind of as a frenzy in this miraculous present moment, right? So one gives some kind of psychological loyalty to all of this profuse and profound imagination. And we, you could say, constructively fail to see or fail to inhabit the curious plasma of presence itself because we're living psychiatrically. We don't know how to turn the spigot on the transmutational potential of the present moment to discover what this might be other than memory, other than hallucination, other than projection. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay. And all of that, which doesn't actually require any time. There's no chronology, right? There's actually no this, then that, then this, then that, then this, then that. The entirety of the fractal matrix of hallucination is present. And you could say in a weird way refreshes without the passage of time. It's not like you became a victim of hallucination when you were conceived or when you were born or when you were two. Right?
Right.
You can't point to a time that goes, I remember it. It was a bad day. It was a rainy day. You know, the French fries were cold. I had applesauce all over my face. I had a bad cold. And that was the day, fuck me, that belief took hold of me.
No, certainly can't point to that.
You can't, right? So that what that would suggest, and I mean this in an encouraging manner, is that any way that you or I or anyone self-frames, they're doing so at present.
Yep, I'm with you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, this self-framing that happens of its own nature, right, spontaneously, and actually occurs non-dually. Self-framing does not require time. Which is fun to play with. Because we think that we're a product of conditioning, whether hereditary, congenital, or postpartum, right, environmental. But what if present consciousness, as in the irrefutability of this moment, is actually not the consequence of anything?
Yeah, wow.
It's fucked up in a fun way.
It is.
So if this so-called apparitional wonder field, libidinal wonder field, of fractal replication, radiant expression, and, you know, biologic fortitude, is not actually the consequence of anything, then it can start to be a little strange. Your confidence or one's confidence in the irrefutability of presence is not also attended by some kind of genesis. Now, we go back, if you don't mind, to the simple question of, does the appearance of consciousness and all that it may imply actually convey agency?
It's a good,
It's a decent question, right?
Decent question, yes. And
isn't your present moment and all that is cacophonously appearing doing so completely impersonally?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see anyone walking up to me or you from moment to moment asking for our signature, right, to approve the present moment.
Right.
So that this is appearing in all the ways that it is appearing is occurring spontaneously, impersonally. We may argue from a materialist point of view that the biological coherence, right, is the product of plant matter. I mean, Nirsagadatta was big on referring to this as a food body, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. He was saying, oh, big deal, food body. And the food body implies plant energy, and the plant energy suggests photosynthesis. And the photosynthesis suggests more transmutation of vital humors and vital powers so that this radiant expression, biologic or, you know, we could go through the various kingdoms, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the entire rainbow of the electromagnetic spectrum. From a physicist point of view, you could say it's particle wave, right? It's photonic, it's chemical, it's non-dually appearing. The 60 to 100 trillion cells that we may be made of are pretty much going about their own business, and not a single one of them is checking in with the likes of you, are they?
No, right.
Not a single cell is saying, Chris, could we get your signature on this work order?
Right, no. And I really like the photosynthesis that really brings it home. Like that's coming from, right, it's not from the ground up. It's
yes. I mean, you can look at the Krebs cycle, right, and the punch of adenosine diphosphate and adenosine triphosphate popping you into sentient reliability. It's not the human body that likes glucose. It's the mitochondria that likes glucose. The mitochondria is actually the one that's gobbling up the glucose and shifting the cycle so that the cell can re-pop.
Right.
And mitochondria is not human. It does not have, nor does it come from human DNA strands. You are a symbiont. Every human being is a symbiont of mitochondrial fortitude, which is the actual ingredient that permits photosynthesis to be utilized by you. And, of course, your gut and bowels and mouth even are a veritable sewer of bacterial and viral forms that without them we would collapse into a heap of, you know, putrid gas.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so even consciousness, which is stranger than even these profound biological processes, is what exactly? Nobody has a clue.
No, not me.
Not me. You know, you look at someone like David Chalmers, who at least has the guts as a, you know, renowned PhD scientific investigator to refer his consciousness, to refer to it as the hard problem.
Yeah.
Meaning that we can use a materialist view to kind of pretend that we have a bead on the reality of all of these other systems. But consciousness, give me a break. There's no reason why this compendium of mitochondria, you know, so-called human DNA, viral and bacterial formations, the mastication of plant life or animal life, which is a way of converting sunlight into usable energy.
Right.
So what? That doesn't mean that there should be consciousness.
And when you said that before, how did you, that question really stuck with me. Is there an agency for consciousness? Is that what
does consciousness, and I'm using consciousness just as a metaphor to point to present irrefutability.
Okay.
Does it convey agency?
Oh. Yeah.
That's pretty fucking weird.
It is.
So the typical, let's say, muggle in an endearing manner says, absolutely it does. Consciousness conveys agency.
I want to say that too.
I think, I do, I choose, I suffer, I admire, I aspire, I realize. And the wizard might say, not so sure about that.
So it just is then? There's no, that's, I think that's more, I mean, myself, I do want to say there's an agency because I want to have something to hold on to. But when you're reading, or from reading your words and other people, it's just, it's all like, it's all going on at once.
Isn't the full palette of experience, you know, appearing as a truly non-dual spontaneity?
Yes.
So if you consider, or one considers, the texture and the nature of present experience, including the heretical myth of decision-making and choice-making, or reporting on the nature of experience, we can see that all of that is kind of after the fact. It's referential. So everything appearing in, may I refer to it as loquacious consciousness, is referential.
Okay.
So can you, and of course that's a rhetorical question, because the answer is already, of course you can. Can you as a sense the presence of your own irrefutability that is present, absolutely unencumbered by rhetoric, by referential reporting? Isn't your present experience, quite frankly, doing itself, absolutely unencumbered by any referential intervention?
Yes.
Big day. That's a big day when without being bullied or bullshitted, you can, for yourself, of your own accord and autonomous intelligence, see that your present experience is appearing in you, as you, to you, absolutely unencumbered and absolutely free from any reference.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
That was easy.
Right.
Now, this seed will take you down. The way that it takes you down is that you find out that attenuating to irrefutability without reference happens to be unabashedly joyous, unabashedly joyful, in a transhuman kind of way. And that's how it replaces the habit of particularizing your present experience with you at the center of it. you discover that you're feeling yourself. And that awareness is so strangely untethered and untetherable. And this is harkens back to Nirsagadatta's most poignant encouragements, which were, oh, so awareness is present, and awareness is capable of being cognizant of itself. That doesn't mean symptoms or reference or storyline or seeking or suffering or making sense of anything at all. Irrefutability is present. You are of the nature, or this consciousness, call it that, is of the nature of this irrefutability. And somehow it finds a pathway to be, you could say, absolutely interested and fascinated with itself. Now, some people of a more Christian kind of bent might criticize or deride you for being selfish or self-consumed, right?
Right.
They would be mistaken. In Ramesh's own words, all there is consciousness. Consciousness is all there is. In Nirsagadatta's words, he would say, watch out for consciousness, it's apparitional. Don't get hooked on consciousness. It's the child of a barren woman.
I've never heard that before.
Glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So without...
Or you.
Without converting to secondhand information, and I'm not talking now about teachers that you've read, right, or meditations that you've had. I'm talking about the fantastic capacity for present experience to appear as secondhand information. And it does so when it's filtered through what we can call thinking, reference, storyboarding, scrapbooking, past and future, aspiration. That's the soul hallucination, is that present experience is quite capable of duping itself into being the product of something, or that it's about something, or that there is an I who's on the receiving end of this non-dual unicity.
Yeah, now that's, you know, that's just lovely. I can't internalize that, but whenever I read that, and you've put that in a lot of your posts.
Well, you needn't internalize it, because internalizing it would suggest that you've made it your bitch. But the thrill here is that consciousness or reality has made you its bitch. And you're happy for the revelation. Even the curious vector, and I certainly can appreciate it, of thinking that you could or should internalize anything is another, what could we say, foray into fetishizing the nature of your present experience. In other words, to internalize something, there would have to be a something. And then there would have to suggest some agency that could be successful at this remarkable internalization. So you become a free agent, which you, of course, already are, by, you could say, remember the those commercials about feed a fever and starve a cold or vice versa, right?
Right, yes.
Okay. So as you tune to the immaculate nature of present irrefutability, everything else goes on a starvation diet. You're already perfectly, intelligently, responsibly non-dual, to coin a phrase. But the moment you think that this is sufficiently about something that would that you might benefit from the internalization of it, see, now you've created agency again.
Yeah.
Right? Psychologically, you've separated yourself from the irrefutability of your own non-dual experience by saying, oh, that sounded like a great idea or a great metaphor, and one day maybe I'll internalize it.
Right.
You're not going to be successful at internalizing it. And that's not because you're not up to snuff. No one has ever been successful at internalizing anything.
There's not just one big, I think for years I've always felt that there should be sort of one big Shazam moment or whatever, where it becomes clear. And
You're absolutely right. Tag, you're it. This is that moment. This is that moment. Every moment you've ever lived, presuming you have, or presuming there is a present moment, this is that moment. This is the Shazam. This is both the window and the actualization to absolute non-dual transmogrification, if I'm probably adding too many syllables unnecessarily. This is it. This is God. This is the entirety. But we're so conditioned out of, let's just call it superstition and superficiality, to say, well, Jesus, this can't be it. I'm still here. Or I'm still me. Or, you know, what? Where are the angels? I'm on my deck. It's a lovely sunset. Where are the angels? Right? Duh.
When my kid come home, I still have to cook him dinner. I thought that maybe someone else was going to cook him dinner.
you were hoping that maybe Ramana Maharshi would come streaming into your backyard in a diaper and make dinner for everyone.
Some kind of
A little rice, and dal would be nice, right? Yeah.
Well,
yeah. So you can. I mean, this is the. You could say this is the heart of the yoga. The heart of the yoga is to reveal how easily, charmingly, consciousness conjures the hallucination of space-time and holds out for a Shazam, which is other than right now. In doing that, you could say consciousness is successful at self-obscuring, because now it's convinced you that there's a Shazam in your future. Rather than your non-dual unicity is actually staring you in the face. So we get this kind of lovely encounter or startle, and we feel it. We have an instinct that it's got to be the case. It must be the case. But it doesn't necessarily spontaneously set us free from familiarity or inertia. Right?
Right, yeah.
So the yoga, therefore, is, you could say, two-pronged. And this is true in the Kashmir and the Dzogchen, you know, traditions. Step one is the, you could say, the realization of what's referred to as Rigpa, which I could say is the fondness that you have for your own non-dual irrefutability being so. Yeah. Okay, cool. Now, once that's so, you know, the bells, the church bells may start ringing, but most likely they won't. But it doesn't mean you've failed. It just means that now we attenuate or recalibrate the curious magic of awareness itself. You could say back on itself. We don't have to sit on a cushion and roll our eyes up or retreat from the world for this, you could say, practice or affection to be cogently and constructively present all the time. Because your irrefutability is affectionately, cogently, coherently present all the time. Now it's a matter of, you could say, withdrawing from any confidence in referential hallucination. Don't, in other words, don't self-accuse.
Like, you know, instantly, yeah, you know, I haven't had the big bang or the big, you know, I've read so many stories, and that's always how it's.
Those stories suck. And all the fuckers that wrote those stories suck. Because you can see what it does for you or many of us, as in countless tens or hundreds of thousands. It's like if I don't have some kind of spontaneous death experience while lying on the floor, I missed it. Right? Yeah. It's nonsense. If realization is so, if the unencumbered nature of non-dual experience is so, then it's not possible for it to be out of reach. Or elsewhere.
Yes. Yeah.
And therefore, it's not necessary to have some kind of cathartic big bang for you to become absolutely affectionate with the presence of your own transmutative consciousness. You can hang out in the confidence of your non-dual irrefutability without being a beggar for a big bang. You can stand as tall as Ramana or Nirsagadatta or the seventh Zen patriarch. No one has the right or the authority to suggest otherwise.
There isn't, like, you know, I've always been, it's not pretentious to feel that way, or it's not, you know.
No.
I want that.
Why would we, you could say, dysfunctionally, not accusing you or anyone, hold out? Because I haven't been, you know, given a baton. Or, you know, the master of the universe hasn't offered me a daisy. I mean, what is appearing in the beatitude outside your back porch? Is that something other than the divine?
No.
Is that a triviality of some kind? Or is what's appearing to you God herself? And that it's appearing, as are you appearing, as God herself, how is it that you are any less than those whose stories and lives and teachings you may have appreciated. How could you possibly be anything less? That's why I, you know, would suggest, because we're all so good at it, you know, certainly not singling you out. We're all really very good at self-accusing. And we do so, can we say, out of ignorance or convenience. It's a little weird that this present experience felt the way that it's felt, absolutely unencumbered by any referentiality, is God in her entirety. Tag, you're it. And the freedom is not so much that one has some kind of big bang. You could say the freedom is that this is not about anything. There's no authority above you, before you, below you, to the left or the right. You are the sole occupant, the sole authority, the sole source of joy unimaginable. Right now. And it's not about anything. Maybe in this way we become slowly or startlingly weaned from the hallucination that this has to amount to something, or that I should be a holdout for an evocative or demonstrative experience. That's, you could say, the second prong of the yoga. Not my yoga. I don't know anything. I'm not the enjoyer of any enlightenment experience. Nothing ever happened to me. I mean, it may be glib. Feel free to excuse yourself with no notice.
I'll take another 5 minutes. I'll keep my kids at bay for a bit. I'm really enjoying this, Jeff.
My pleasure, indeed. I don't remember what I was saying, but it doesn't matter.
I can see. I listen now, but you've really given me a lot to
Any form of self-qualifying that you or any of us may do is referential. It's hypnagogic. We don't have any authority to make any accusation about our present experience. And when we relieve ourselves of the false sense of authority that could possibly make this about anything, well, aren't you free where you stand?
Yep.
Yes. Without reference, without accusation, without the presumption of authority, you're free where you stand.
What was wrong with Christ, Jeff? Was he a blasphemer?
In a moment. Let's have Chris have his closure before he goes to make dinner.
I'm going to let you go, Jeff, and I'd love to rejoin you next week when I can. So thank you for this.
Thanks for joining us. Your company was most appreciated.
We appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sure. So what are we doing now? Taking pot shots at Christ?
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not? He came up with this line of bull that you forgiveness and love is the story. What the fuck where did that come from?
You know, I wish I really wish that if we could get our hands on a time machine, we could just kind of go hang out and say, Master, what up?
Yes, what up?
You know, and hear it from, you know, his own his own lips, rather than the filtration of the Casa Nostra of the church.
Yes, modified to suit oneself.
Yeah, I mean, any institution that encourages its luminaries to wear big hats, watch out.
Especially red ones.
Yeah, especially. I mean, the one exception to that might be Dr. Seuss and the cat in the hat. Everyone else is suspicious. The cat in the hat was cool.
I mean, the whole New Age world has bought into that. They've dropped off the 2.2 billion Christians and are adopting that notion that there's something that's the fundamental nature of it all.
Yes, it's always fun, and I love to gossip about everyone and everything. But, you know, anything that we observe in the groupthink of others or institutions is really most advantageous when we see that it might be alive and well in my own consciousness.
Well, that's why I'm raising it.
Okay. Rock and roll.
Yeah.
So the gullibility that the Scientologists suffer from, that you could say the Christians or the Jews or the Islamicists or the Baha'i or the New Agers or the non-dualists suffer from. I mean, everyone and everything is under the profuse and profound beguilement of, you know, the sacred rumination itself. That's the way this fucker rolls.
Mm.
So any, you could say, legitimate criticism or disappointment that we could have of the institutions that we've either known or been thrown out of, and that includes, you know, Buddhist retreat centers and Landmark and you name it. Everyone and everything seems to suffer from a foundational or fundamental hallucination, which is that this apparitional wonder field is about something, or that it conveys something, and therefore I must work diligently to be on the top of my game and or squeeze whatever is possible to be squozen from the miracle of present experience. And that's the same fabric of indulgence and hallucination that all persons and all institutions suffer from.
Yeah.
It's that simple, really. You know, it's no biggie. I mean, you know, and that confusion is so potent that it can turn into
the world that we're living in.
Yes, thank you. I was thinking more historically in terms of the Inquisition and the, you know, blah blah blah. Right. You're right. We have not. We have not graduated from the violation of comparison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the churches thrive on it. Even the Buddhists thrive on it. And the Hindus thrive on it. It's still a relatively few let's call ourselves human beings, that are bold enough and crazy enough not to take ourselves or anybody else prisoner.
Right.
Otherwise, the entire fabric of social, tribal, and communal structures is a hierarchical systematization of taking prisoners.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. So, in a sense, then we are you're on your own.
Exactly. It.
Yeah, you're on your own because one's own consciousness has the miraculous capacity to obscure or to realize.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, there's a certain pleasure in that and joy.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I don't know who else is on the call, but I discovered that I am only energy. This is one of those things that should be in the New Yorker, a cartoon.
Yeah.
I've been the whole... As long as I've been around and can remember, I have accumulated what would be called a lint ball in my belly button.
That's right. Yep. It's so large you can probably take it to the moon.
Yeah. Do you have them?
I haven't checked lately, but I will.
I mean, haven't you ever noticed that you had a lint ball in your belly button?
I have found several, and I actually... I dated them. I dated them, and I framed them.
Yes.
Well, oh, I'm just kidding.
Very good. I'm gonna propose that it is all the evidence we need that we are a totally energetic being, and that's the trace of the energy that is rotating around into our belly button. I mean, I've never. I'm sure there is lint in the T-shirts I wear.
Oh yeah.
I'm sure that as I walk and move, the hairs on my body must dislodge them. But how the hell do they get down into my belly button?
I don't know. That's
what is that shit going on?
It's a vortex.
It's a vortex we have walking around in us, black hole.
So it's the inner black hole.
Creating the
atmospheric conditions for lint to magnetize inside the navel.
And it drags it in and weaves it into a nest, a ball.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I don't have a microscope to detect how fine these particles are. But when you accumulate enough of them, you can throw them at somebody.
Yeah, that's right. And I think if the ball is large enough, it conveys instantaneous realization.
Right. I just take a minute. I've been pondering that for, these many years. It just came to me.
You have an enviable imagination.
I give evidence to the fact that I am nothing.
Yeah,
just a vortex collecting lint.
Yeah, that's
it's a joy to walk around thinking about that.
Yeah, no, it's a blast. I mean, that observation should get as much play as anything Thich Nhat Hanh has ever written.
I really think so. Yeah. I agree with you.
I think it could probably help a bunch of people with, anger and regret and post-traumatic stress syndrome to discover that, oh my gosh, I am just the nature of, of...
the universe.
Yeah, right.
The whole fucking cosmos.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And further, that the lint is not qualified to go to the inside. it gets dropped off before it disappears into the void.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's time to write a note to Stephen Hawking.
I hope he will reply. I hope he has the courage to reply.
I just thought it tickled me so much I couldn't wait to share it with you.
Yeah, I hear you. Lately I like to, what would you say? How is it possible to, let's say, dance in a celebratory fashion around the fire of present consciousness?
Yeah.
You know, Don Juan, whether imaginary or legitimate, gave Carlos some great advice, you know, which was make sure to dance, you know, at your death.
Right.
You know, I mean, get up and whoop. Shout, you know, whoop it up. Say thank you with whatever ounce of strength you may have left to express the profound sacred gratitude for all that you have been given and all that you have seen. And that gesture is present.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The invocation was don't wait until the uncertainty of your physical death. Right? Dance that dance now.
Right away.
Yeah. Yeah. Dance it. You could say dance it every day. What? Dance it at the remarkable interface where consciousness suggests to you that there is presence.
I get such a kick out of it because I feel like I caught that fucking universe doing something. And thought I could get away with it without anybody noticing. I caught you, you little fucker.
There you go. Who would have thunk that something as intimate as a lint ball in the navel could be a reflection of the hide and seek that consciousness plays with itself?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Tickled as hell about it.
Well, sure. I mean, every grandeur or every minutia of consciousness itself and what is appearing in consciousness is a reflective revelation of the physics of black hole consciousness.
We are nothing.
Yeah. Yes, it's lovely to look at the nature of present experience and refer to it as nothing. It has a kind of thrilling, liberating quality to that this is nothing at all. And similarly, not antithetically, that this is all and everything,
mm-hmm.
while being nothing at all, has, can convey a similar thrill.
Right. Damn.
It's like consciousness was not conveyed at conception or birth or even at Big Bang.
Uh-huh.
Right? If there is consciousness, its conveyance is now. It's not like you or I are the product of a consciousness previously conveyed.
Right. There's only one moment.
Yes. And so in this so-called moment, because we don't have a better word for it, you know, at the moment, I mean, we could refer to it as navel lint, but moment is also a plausible word. So at this so-called moment where consciousness is apparitionally expressing. It's possible to see or sense that consciousness is also not expressing.
Mm-hmm.
That it's so sweetly evaporative.
Right.
That it's just as easy to uninhabit mm-hmm. as it is to inhabit.
Mm.
And that's the proverbial fork in the road of the interface of what's referred to as samsara and nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
Samsara is habitation.
Right.
Consciousness conveying habitation or inhabitation. And nirvana is, ha ha ha, you got to be kidding me. Just because there's a magical field of apparitional potential does not insist upon inhabitation. That would be the nirvana side of the coin.
Yeah. Tricky little fella, huh?
It is so scrumptiously tricky. But when we, like our friend Chris that was on the call earlier, when we hold out thinking that some kind of shebang needs to occur to us as some evidence of liberation, well, we remain in that, what is it when they throw you in the hole in prison?
Right.
Solitary confinement, right? When we're holding out for something that appears to be other than us and outside of us, to gift us with some kind of shebang, we actually place ourselves in solitary confinement.
Yeah, I would call it expectational solitary confinement.
Sure. Yes, those are the same. That it is expectational conjures the hallucination of time. And this same leaping off point, not that any leaping need be done, is just as fecund with the absence of inhabitation. Consciousness doesn't actually convey agency.
Well, that's a trick. It doesn't convey anything. So I don't understand if the realizational people have a realization. What inspires them to turn it into an apparition?
All is done spontaneously and impersonally and only apparitionally so. So we can't legitimately accuse anyone, including ourselves, of anything, including selecting a dubious path.
That's a prison with no bars.
Yes, that's right. But you could say it does. Require, or let's say it enjoys, the adventure enjoys a certain quality of reflection, of rumination, of textural attenuation,
mm-hmm.
to begin to peer into the apparitional nature of present experience. And find the courage not to turn away from it. And you could just say this, you know, this cultivation occurs organically. Sometimes through the grace of suffering, the grace of consideration, the grace of the presence, you know, of a teacher or a teaching, we somehow become more interested in context rather than content, mm-hmm. and consciousness matures, if we could suggest, that it becomes capable of looking into and at itself with a deep quality of affection. And it reveals itself as immersive.
It pretty much offers the dissolution of the world.
Exactly. Here, as in this moment, is both the presentation of the world and, curiously enough, the evaporation of the world. Or you could say the release from any genesis of the world.
Yeah.
Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Dad, what's up?
What's happening?
I just got back from seeing Mom.
All right, well, we're happy to help you decompress.
Oh, my God. So I had 2.5 hours of Mom and wife.
Oh.
Just sitting.
A double talking. Banger.
Yeah, talking about how bad the world is.
Wow. Wow, too bad you weren't high.
That's a good idea.
Really? If you can't put the Valium in their soda, you may as well get high yourself.
Yeah. I thought just because I'm so spiritually mature,
yes,
that I could sit there and just look at them as radiant presence, but it didn't work.
You failed, huh?
I failed. I failed the test.
Well, you're a bold man for even, you know, agreeing to the examination.
Yes.
I mean, how do we know where we're at except through failure? success has never amounted to much.
I thought you were going to say, how do we know except for through family?
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, when it comes to family, we have a sentimental obligation to, you know, endure it, maybe even enjoy it.
Yeah, and, what's that all about?
But we don't suffer, you know, other idiots with that same kind of patience.
No.
Well,
why do we do that?
Call it love.
Yeah, what is that? What does that mean, Jeff?
I don't know. I mean, you could, you know, you could abandon your family. It happens in the East. I mean, even Papaji abandoned his family and his children to go find Ramana Maharshi. And, you know, as the story goes, Papaji enjoyed some kind of revelation or realization, and Ramana said, well, why don't you just go home? He said, I never thought of that. Yeah, really. Why don't you like take that diaper off and, you know, wear regular clothes and just go home? It's non-afflictive.
Yeah. And then Mom starts talking about spiritual things, about religion and stuff. That's weird. She actually said she thinks there's a devil. Mom.
Yeah. Do we have to go there again? Right?
What do you say to her?
Jeez, I don't know. Well, you know, what you could do is...
My mom thinks Jeff is the devil. So. Because...
Your mom might be right.
What do you say to that? You're like, well, you're probably right.
You're probably right.
That's hilarious.
Beelzebub himself. I think it's useful to, let's say, cope with the vicissitudes of family as a wizard might, you know, as a shaman might. So you don't go into the situation undefended or without, let's just say, some magical talisman. You bring a magical talisman with you, and that will see you through.
And what is the magical talisman?
Well, it can be anything, really. And it kind of depends on, you know, your environment, your creativity, the circumstances, or the, you know, the magical signs that may appear to you. Because once you go in search of a talisman, one will certainly appear.
Sometimes I take a nap while my wife and mother talk.
That is a form of magical talisman.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be a guitar pick in your case, you know, or it could be a twig, right? I mean, it could be something as funny as a rabbit's foot or that little, I think it's that Italian symbol that looks kind of like a, you know, a devil's horn or something. I forget what they call it, but there's all kinds of talismans basically at your disposal as you speak. What's missing is the imagination or the animation that you bring to the talisman, so that when you have an encounter with the muggle-like consciousness of one's parents or perhaps even one's spouse, that by virtue of animating the talisman, it anchors you. I mean, that's what a shaman would do, and you know, why not?
But why would you need the object?
You don't. It's you really don't. In the beginning, it's useful to seek the object, capture the object, imbue the object, and then bring it with you. Just for fun, right? Then later on, that you have, let's say, opened that portal in your own consciousness, that talismen are real, and that they are animated by the likes of you, then you don't need to bring them along for the ride any longer.
I think they made movies on this stuff.
Well, they have. I mean, I've used the Tibetan Purba on a number of occasions.
But that,
with, you know, with friends and co-sojourners to unwind from, you could say, sticky karmic situations. Yeah. The Purba is a three-sided dagger, which is not meant for injury or wound. But it, you could say it represents, depending on the schema you're fond of, you know, three portals of reality, or Nirmanakaya, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, or other aspects of three. And you can use the Purba as a key to open up portals into the holo fractal nature of present experience, and practice a little magic, which is more about availability than it is about assertion, right? Magic is more about availability than it is about casting spells.
I mean, isn't that just about the same as all the tricks that Peter, you know, mentions?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all tricks.
Well, isn't your present consciousness a trick? Right? Isn't the confidence that you or I might place in my present consciousness and experience a trick?
No, well, yeah, but I don't think I have any control over it. It just happens, you know. Even the way that I feel, I could sit at one of these, you know, visits sometimes, and I'm just in presence, and it's just like I just watch it happening. It's awesome. And then other days, it's like terrifying. But yeah. I could be at home and do the same thing.
Sure.
I could be sitting in my chair and being in terrifying agony. Yes. And then I could be sitting in my chair and be in Wonderland, you know? So
yes.
What's like, it's like, what's, who's in control of that? You know, it's just, it's whatever happens, happens. It comes and goes.
Well, yes, you can, one can be, and I don't mean this as a derangement of any kind, fatalistic. In terms of, well, I don't have any control. All of this comes and goes. But that doesn't stop you from interfacing with your present experience in a playful and evocative manner.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get it. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I'm gonna exercise for an hour now because that's what I need. So that's the same thing.
There you go.
That's what I
okay.
need to unwind, you know.
Okay. Right. So, you know, after your cells and consciousness have been bathed in the socializing with your mom, you know, you can feel the need for some kind of discharge.
Yeah.
Right. To come back to a more equanimous sobriety. Yes. And so when you're next invited to socialize in that way.
Next Tuesday, you mean?
Like next Tuesday, for instance. And if you remember and then give yourself the permission to play with it, you might want to experiment with some kind of talisman.
Well, you surprised me tonight, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, it's always, you know, to play some kind of game as if this is absolutely on autopilot, you know, it's a little too glib, right? Because this is, it's magical. I mean, your present consciousness, while it may be perfectly and impersonally broadcast, is also marvelously creative and self-reflecting. So it doesn't mean that we have to be fatalistic about the nature of present experience. We can be playfully cooperative with the nature of present experience. You could say as a reminder of how fractal the field is, rather than, let's say, suffering through a lengthy conversation that I'd rather not be in.
Well, I don't think of it as fatalistic. I think of it as realistic that as a human being, you have ups and downs, and you feel good sometimes and you feel shitty sometimes.
Yes.
And realizing that and accepting that just makes it, in other words, I'll sit there and feel shitty, but I won't feel shitty about feeling shitty, you know? I'll be like, oh, this is just, that's how I feel right now. And it means I'm probably going to feel better later on, believe it or not, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
you know. You're going to feel shitty, you're going to feel good, you know.
Sure.
No matter what. If you want to play games and stuff, I guess you can play games with it, but you're not going to, I don't think you're going to offset the almost the 50-50, you know, feeling of ups and downs, you know.
I think that's, you know, up to you. I mean, I bow at your feet. If that's how it appears to you, then, you know, who would I be to suggest otherwise?
Well, I mean, there is a difference of presence behind that. You know, in other words, there is a sitting in a kind of a more of a non-attachment to that human being that's feeling the agony. You know what I mean? There's a little more spaciousness behind the whole thing.
Spaciousness, that, yes.
Which I think gets more depth as time goes on. It seems anyway.
Yes, sure. I mean, you are the sovereign overseer of the profundity of your own experience. And so if spaciousness is appearing and, you know, the coming and going of human joy and human befuddlement is present, I trust you. But even the reporting on anything that may have happened prior to this moment, or that might even be happening in this moment, is partial, referential, anecdotal, and most likely completely untrue.
Bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I mean, and that includes all of us, right? No one's being singled out from that one.
Yeah. Well, aren't you guys lucky that I caught the end of your session just to give you my story?
I feel that way.
I said, geez, they did probably have 5 more minutes. Let me see if I can ruin it for them.
We are. It's wonderful for you to drop in and give us the opportunity to assist you in a camaraderie that helps you disentangle from a samsaric adventure. Yeah. Have a great workout. What else can we say?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, good. I think what we'll do is play our outro. We'll dance a little bit, and then we'll end the call.
All right, guys.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. I said the right thing. Beth's in there.
Thanks, everybody.
All right.
We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Jeff.
Bye.